This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
The principal of an all-boys Catholic high school on Chicago's South Side won the prestigious Golden Apple Award.
My ceiling is their floor.
Yeah.
That's what I hope that they see.
Mayor Brandon Johnson says he will head overseas later this month to visit Pope Leo XIV.
I'm going to bring my Cubs hat. I'm not sure if he's going to wear it, but I'm going to bring it.
I know I'm biased, but it is true that this really was, in 2024, the best convention.
Hey, Chicago. I'm Mary Dixon, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday. It's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week with our weekly news recap. Former Chicago mayoral candidate Paul Vallas is fined for violating campaign finance rules. Mayor Johnson announces plans to meet with the Pope in Rome. And there's a lot going on with CPS.
We cannot tell our children, no, we do not have enough for you because we are building a beautiful new stadium.
CPS is in the red big time.
We have to make decisions based on the revenue sources that we have.
How do you have school without teachers? That's what you have to ask Springfield.
Our assistant principals keep our schools safe and keep the entire school community functioning.
Why do we continue to move policy that has demonstrated that it doesn't work? What works in this moment is to fully invest in our public institutions.
We'll get into these stories and much more, but let's start today's episode with a look at an important change coming to Chicago this fall. For the first time, the entire Chicago School Board will be on the ballot. With us is WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp. She was one of our panelists this week. So good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
So it's an important election. It's coming up this fall. Help us understand these historic changes to the Chicago School Board.
So Chicago Public Schools has never had a fully elected school board. Prior to mayoral control, which came into effect in 1995, we had a nomination process, but it was not elected. Right now, we have a partly elected, partly appointed board. And next, coming in November, we're going to have a fully elected board, including a school board president that will be an at-large position elected by everybody in the city of Chicago.
So Chicago will be divided up into representative areas for these seats on the board, but then everybody gets to vote for the board president.
Exactly, exactly. So people's district, I mean, it's a little funky because you're either in 1A or 1B, 2A or 2B, but you're in a district.
Okay. And school board candidates, they can start filing their nominating petitions on Monday?
On Monday. And so, and they have a week. They have till May 26th. So we'll start seeing people line up. I've got a press release today about one of the school board candidates for the president's position. He's going to be there at 7 a.m. with his petitions.
Do we know who's going to be running for this citywide head of the Chicago School Board?
We know that there's a number of people that have open campaign committees, including two current members of the school board, Jennifer Custer and Jessica Biggs. We know Sindel Ravaleri, who is a former CPS board member, is going to run. And then there is a fourth person named Victor Henderson, who I don't know all that much about, but he was on the board of Urban Prep Charter School. So he's a businessman, and I'm sure we will be learning a lot more about all of these people as the months go on. And there might be some other candidates out there. I was just saying that there's some big organizations who might actually run candidates who have yet to open up campaign committees or you know, that we just haven't heard
about.
They're
keeping quiet for now.
Right.
But starting Monday, we're going to be learning more about who wants to hold these very important posts.
Right, right. And that's one of the things that we've really learned with the hybrid school board is the importance of the president, because it turns out that's the person who determines what is on the agenda for the board meetings. And so that becomes very important.
I know you'll be following this all throughout the fall. Sarah Karp, WBEZ education reporter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's jump into the recap. Also at the table, along with Sarah, to help make sense of the week's news, Monica Eng, Axios Chicago reporter, and Paris Schutz, political and investigative reporter at NBC5. First things first, just as the school year is winding down, came not-so-welcome news about staff cuts at Chicago Public Schools, and Sarah started us off.
So yes, this week, the school district finally sent principals information about how many staff they'll have in their school next year, and it was not good. They were told that they are increasing the teacher-to-staff ratio by one for every school, every grade.
So 23 students to one teacher instead of 22, or, you know, pick a number.
Right, exactly. Okay. And so this will result, the school district was very, you know, they did not want to say how many teachers this is going to result in being laid off. They also didn't very much do not want to say that class sizes will rise, though fewer teachers kind of makes sense. Sizes will have some issue to deal with. But I looked at last year's allocations and last year's budget, and I think that this will probably result in between 700 and 800 teachers being laid off.
Okay, and that is also due to an analysis that you were able to do. So,
right, right.
You know, I mean, this isn't just off the top of your
head. No, not at all, not at all. I mean, and I checked it with the school district. They didn't push back. Okay. If they thought I was totally off, they would have been like,
absolutely,
you're totally
not
off,
Sarah.
Right? That's right. That's right.
And it isn't the first time in 3 years that CPS is proposing some kind of staff reduction that is going to affect kids in classrooms.
For sure. And a lot of the layoffs over the last 2 years or 3 years have been sort of at the edges. So, for example, during the pandemic, they hired a lot of interventionists who are supposed to help struggling teachers. Those interventionists, some of them were laid off. Also, there are fewer school lunch workers, things like that. Tutors were laid off. So there's all of these different little things, not little, but things sort of at the periphery, but not teachers. And so that's what's big about this announcement.
And it's the end of COVID relief funds, which is part of the issue here, the funding issue.
Right. And a lot of people will make this argument that the school district hired a lot of people with COVID relief funds. They kind of staffed up. The CEO, Macklin King, says we needed those staff because kids came back from the pandemic with a lot of learning loss. But now they're saying maybe we can trim a little bit and not feel as much impact.
Okay. And then, Monica, you had a story in Axios this week about some demographic changes at CPS. What's going on there?
Well, you know, as CPS lost about 86,000 students over the last 15 years, it actually gained more than 2,000 white students. And that's as white children have left the city in general.
Hmm.
So I wanted to understand that. Was it, you know, part of the selective enrollment school expansion? Although it hasn't expanded that much over the last 15 years. But there was an Economist story that looked at how this is happening in sort of hipster areas of San Francisco, Brooklyn. So looked at Park Slope, Bernal Heights, and Wicker Park in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And they're seeing this big sort of rush of white children there. At the same time, CPS lost more than 70,000 black students.
Okay.
So what does this mean for property taxes? What does this mean for school allocation? That's interesting. I wanted to just piggyback on Sarah's story. You know, full disclosure, my daughter is a special ed teacher's assistant in CPS.
Okay.
So that's full disclosure. But I did notice that they said they want to add those, that's an area where they're adding, and Sarah's done great reporting on special education funding. And then they're also going to be removing assistant principals from schools with fewer than 250 students.
Right. So that's the other the other place where they're making some, you know, sort of significant cuts.
Okay. Okay. In that realm of it. So, okay. That's interesting. Obviously, this is going to be something developing over the years. Let's get to the politics of funding CPS Paris.
Yeah.
They're still hoping. We've got, what, another 2 weeks of Illinois General Assembly session time before they go into overtime.
Right.
What are the odds that their CPS is going to get more money from the state?
Well, this is deja vu for everybody that covers CPS. Is the cause of and the solution to all of CPS's financial woes, according to the teachers union and many CPS officials and the mayor, is always Springfield. And this is going back to mayors from, you know, the past. They're always looking to Springfield for more money. And the teachers union and Mayor Johnson has claimed over and over again for years now that the state is shorting CPS almost $2 billion based on this evidence-based funding model that the state General Assembly approved many years ago. It's true, but it's also not true. So it's complicated. Based on that model, CPS and all public school districts should be getting more money from the state. But the idea was that the state was going to ramp up to that funding at a future date. So every year they ramp up a little more. So when the mayor and the CTU president goes down and says, you owe us this money, eventually, at a later date, and there's no legal mechanism to compel Springfield to spend that money right now.
By the way, the future date is this year. It's 2027 that they were supposed to have the evidence-based formula fully funded. So let's just be honest about this. It's not like 10 years from now. I mean, this is the date. Now, it's probably the way they've been doing it is about $350 million a year, and actually a little less the last couple years. And it's going to take till 2034 to get there.
Right.
And this is a formula that was based on research for what schools need in order to provide an adequate education for students. And so that's what they were looking at. They're not like, they didn't just come up with you know, some crazy number. They tried to look at research and, you know, how many social workers you need, how many teachers you need, how many counselors you need. So I think that's an important caveat. You know, it's not just somebody dreamed up. And it actually was passed when Rauner, who is a Republican, Governor Rauner, was the governor. And so it's not like also that it wasn't supported by, you know, people on every side of the aisle.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, I think there's a political and a policy motivation to tie this to the Bears mega projects legislation. You saw some board members, and the teachers union has gone in hard opposing the mega projects legislation. But they're saying that, like, if you have the ability to cut this kind of deal to save billions for major billion-dollar NFL teams, and why can't you fund education to the level that, as Sarah said, that research has shown that the state should be funding? And we know that Illinois has been an outlier in terms of one of the poorest funded states in terms of funding coming from the state, which is why one of the reasons why so many communities in Illinois have record high property taxes, because they're spending money on education.
So it was ever thus. This argument about adequate education funding has been going on for decades in Illinois. The CPS and the Bears have been, you know, there with their hands out, and there is another deadline coming. Let's turn to what the CPS Superintendent Macklin King is going to be doing while the kids are out of school this summer. I understand she has been subpoenaed to testify before the U.S. House Education Committee. What's going on, Sarah?
Yeah, well, this Education Committee has been asking her to testify since April, and it's been going back and forth. I guess she was like, first she said, I declined. Then she said, you know what? My schedule doesn't permit. And now they're subpoenaing her. And so she's, I guess she's compelled to testify.
Well, usually a subpoena means you're supposed to show up. It doesn't always work, but a subpoena means you got to do it.
Right. And I think the issue here is that this is a hearing about basically how the school district addresses transgender students and teaching about sexual orientation. And I think I'm not exactly sure that she thinks that it's in her interest in general to go talk to the Republican Education Committee about these issues.
Well, and the Trump administration is generally threatening to withhold money and grants from programs that center diversity, equity, and inclusion, and, you know, allow for gender expression. So, I mean, there could be potentially a lot to lose while CPS is facing down this deficit situation, no?
That's right. And, you know, we've already, Chicago Public Schools has seen a grant called the Magnet School Program grant cut because of a slightly different reason. The Trump administration says that the school district is violating civil rights law by having something called the Black Student Success Plan, mm-hmm. which is a plan that basically looks at the issues that might be impacting the achievement of Black students who have lagged behind in many measures for a long time, and tries to improve those measures. And they say that by targeting one group for improvement, that the school district is violating civil rights of other students.
Okay, so we will see what happens when she arrives in Washington and is in the hot seat. Talking about what's going on in Springfield, you referred to the teachers union and Mayor Johnson trying their hardest to block the Bear Stadium bill.
Yeah.
And Paris, it feels to me like that ship has sailed.
It's a little late in the game to come in and do this. And Mayor Johnson now today in Crane saying, hey, how about a public-owned stadium in the city? Well, where were you 2 years ago on this? And it's very interesting because he's followed the Illinois Federation of Teachers and the CTU now, both led by Stacey Davis Gates, to really go in hard opposing this mega projects bill. And the question is, why? Why are the teachers unions getting so involved in this? Well, I think we mentioned the policy part of it, but I think there's a political part of it, too. I think they know that if Governor Pritzker is the governor that loses the Bears to Indiana, that would be a pretty bad mark on him should he want to run for president. And maybe they can use this as leverage to extract what they're asking for CPS. It feels late in the game to do that. The ship has sailed, yes, but they do have influence down there. And we have heard from Chicago area state senators that agree, that say, you know what, I'm a no on this. I don't think the Bears should be leaving Chicago. And let's bring up the fact that, you know, let's talk about the policy. Because there are both sides to the argument of this bill. On the one side, yes, no NFL team pays full freight and property taxes. Most of those stadiums are public. And the Bears would be an outlier, and they need certainty, you know, to get the funding they need to build their stadium. On the other side, why do they need to get a special deal here where they're probably going to wind up with these in lieu of fees if the bill passes, paying like between $8 and $12 million a year, when if they're going to pay property taxes on the assessed value of that property, it'd be in the hundreds of millions. So they're going to be saving over the life of this.
We're not holding a bake sale for the McCaskies.
Right,
we're fine.
Right. Speaking so there of are bake legitimate sales, arguments.
Speaking of bake sales, Chicago-based McDonald's has agreed for the first time to put their name on a stadium. They bought the naming rights to the Chicago Fire's proposed South Loop Stadium. What do you all think about Chicago having a McDonald's field?
Well, I think I know what kind of food they'll be serving in the stadium. We can count on some Big Macs. It seemed to be big news. I couldn't believe that they'd never put their name on a stadium before, but they are hometown burger heroes, I guess. And, you know, this whole idea that Mansueto was going to foot the whole thing. Well,
Joe Mansueto, who owns the Chicago Fire.
Right. But Chicago will also be footing some infrastructure money. And I guess McDonald's the rest. And it sounds like we're just going to have stadium after stadium after stadium all downtown.
Well, here's the difference. Joe Mansueto is paying for most of that stadium himself. The government will help with infrastructure costs. And I think a lot of people are okay with that. Joe Mansueto is also a billionaire, like the McCaskies, and he is not asking for a handout from the state.
I really think the naming rights, it's a big lost opportunity for Peter Francis Geraci and the Infotape Stadium.
Where's he?
But maybe he'll name the new Bears Stadium if it's in Arlington or Hammond.
Maybe a lobby or a portal will be named after him.
I mean, the Chicago Stars are going to be up in Evanston for a while. Maybe he can get in there. Let's talk a little bit more about what's going on with the General Assembly. With 2 weeks left in the spring session, again, coming up to deadline, like college freshmen trying to get their papers in at the end of semester.
Always.
A proposal to regulate data centers. Monica, what is the Power Act about?
Power Act has several provisions, but, you know, among them are transparency over how much power and water you use. Also, there's something called a Beyonce provision, bring your own clean energy provision.
I thought we were going to get some concerts.
It's not as exciting as that, but it's really important for these new data centers to be bringing their own clean energy rather than, you know, using the existing energy and making our own energy bills go higher. The problem is it's only had subject matter hearings. So yesterday, the Illinois Environmental Coalition, sorry, Council, which is an umbrella group over a lot of environmental groups, said, hey, Governor Pritzker, remember the one who was so excited about the Clean Energy Jobs Act? Where are you on this? Every time I ask him, I just get this super neutral response. We will be considering all bills that cross the line, blah, blah, blah. It hasn't gotten a single vote yet on a floor. I don't think it's got a committee vote. And this was supposed to be a big deal. In fact, do we remember the headlines that came out after Pritzker's big speech?
Right.
Pritzker wants to put a freeze on all tax incentives for 2 years for data centers. Mm. Guess what? There were no teeth in that. We all gave him great publicity. There were no teeth. Not happening. That requires legislative approval. So where are you, Governor Pritzker, on the same type of legislation that Ron DeSantis in Florida just passed that makes data centers pay their way?
One of the rare bipartisan issues of agreement. I mean, if you poll the public, you know, left and right, conservative, liberal, centrist, the majority are opposed to data centers in their community and want protections.
And yet Joliet just approved a data center, you know, right by Joliet.
Well, the money is very tempting. And Pritzker has been very historically pro-data center, but I think he's seeing the wind shifting. So where is he on this?
Speaking of bills, ComEd customers, we're going to see an increase about 12% in our monthly charges starting next month, just as the summer air conditioning season begins. Some of the increase is because of the end of a tax credit, but some of it is also because of the power demands of data centers. So that is another piece of this. So lawmakers are also grappling in Springfield with artificial intelligence. Some want to rein in the technology with regulation. So, Sarah, there are a number of proposals kind of in play. Can you walk through some of them?
Sure. And I think we're all grappling with how to use AI. I think that's a fair assumption. And so, so Representative Jennifer Gahn-Gershowitz from Glenview, she's pushing for something that would have AI models be defined as products, and that way they could be held liable if they harm users. So that's one thing, because right now, if they harm users, I don't know what the, you know, what
repercussion. It's a little murkier to establish who you can sue.
Yes.
And when we say harm users, you know, some people, it's been alleged, have committed suicide after being prompted by a chatbot.
Right.
Right. And there's a lot of ways. I mean, you know, just the other day I had an experience where I asked the chatbot something and I was trying to buy something and they told me the wrong information. And that's, you know, it can harm you.
Cost you money. It can cost you your health, your life. So we will see what's going on with that. Monica, lawmakers are also talking about a first-in-the-nation law that would limit fees on credit card charges. Is there any movement on that?
This is kind of complicated, but I'll try to simplify it. In 2024, the legislature in Springfield said, hey, you know, we should not, a restaurant, small businesses should not be paying this percentage fee on the tax and tip. Let's say on your restaurant fee. So the tax and tip, we should not have to pay a percentage fee on that. And so July 1st, you know, these fees were going to be gone for Illinois restaurants. Mm-hmm. But the banks and the credit unions, they were like, whoa, we're going to be losing millions of dollars on this. Let's try to challenge this. And it looked like the challenge wasn't going to be successful until this federal agency stepped in and said, yeah, we think federal law trumps Illinois law. You're not going to be able to stop these charges. But then another court today, this week, said, wait a minute, we think this should go to another court. So it's a lot of legal
wrangling
back and forth. But in the end, you're the one who, have you ever gone to a restaurant and said, well, if you use a credit card, here's how much more you're going to pay. We're the ones who end up paying that.
Right.
And, you know, folks, when you go and you share a lunch with a whole bunch of people, do not give them five different credit cards. They have to pay a fee every single time. And these are the kinds of fees that small businesses say are killing them. These would have been gone by July 1st. It's unclear, still back and forth in the courts.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
So, Paris, we just heard Mayor Johnson announcing that he's going to travel to Europe and meet up with the Pope and bring him a Cubs hat.
Yeah, I think the Pope is not going to bless that hat. We know the Pope is a diehard Sox fan, but
he's going to get excommunicated for that.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, no, this is a very interesting meeting. And the mayor says the purpose is he wants to, you know, thank the Pope for his moral clarity in this moment. And you know, the timing of this visit is very interesting. The end of this month, which is also when we're probably going to see all the action in Springfield come to a head. So the mayor will be overseas and not down in Springfield to influence whatever happens on mega projects or CPS funding or any of these other bills that we've talked about. So that's kind of an interesting aside. But also, you know, the mayor and the Catholic Church have been at odds. I mean, the mayor has, you know, obviously the mayor is a big proponent of public education. And there's certain things that the mayor and the local archdiocese have kind of clashed about on that front. But I obviously don't think that's going to be a part of what they talk about.
I can't imagine that's going to come up at the Holy See.
In the Vatican. No, not at the Holy See. So, you know, he'll be... What, the second Chicago public official, Governor Pritzker, has already met with him. And we're told World Business Chicago is paying for this trip, which is kind of that quasi-public-private agency that's, you know, out there to kind of go around the world to generate economic development for Chicago. So I don't know if there's an economic development component.
We should say that the mayor and the Pope are on the same page when it comes
for
immigrant rights. Yeah.
Immigrant rights, they've been completely on the same page on that. And certainly, I mean, you would think that that's what they're going to sort of talk about. And, you know, he'll probably talk about the situation in Chicago and what's at stake, given the political reality in the country right now. And so very interested to see what comes out of this meeting. But again, the mayor, the timing of it is a little suspect, given that the mayor is going in hard on some of these things in Springfield, but yet he will not be there when
so
the
you
things
think
come to a head.
He's skipping town for when things don't go his
I
way.
I mean, it's probably a coincidence, but yeah. Well, right. When thing, you know, now you're predicting the future, but I didn't want to do it. You did it. And it doesn't seem like he's going to get $2 billion more in CPS funding over the next 2 weeks. Mega projects, we don't know what's going to happen on that.
I mean, we will see. I am a witch. Father Bob, Robert Francis Prevost, took on the name of Pope Leo XIV in honor of Pope Leo XIII, who led the church in the late 1800s to 1903. He was known for championing workers' rights and social justice. So in Chicago, we have a Chicago name for Pope Leo XIII, and the principal of Leo Catholic High School, Shaka Rawls, was recently given a prestigious honor. So can you tell us more?
So this is the Golden Apple Award, and I love the Golden Apple season because for about 2 weeks they go and they surprise teachers and principals in the Chicago area with this. They get $5,000. They get some time to take classes at Northwestern University. But also it's just this, they surprise them and all the students are there and their family is there and everyone cries. And it's a very nice moment.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And the thing about this, too, is that Leo High School, which is in Auburn Gresham on the south side, at one point it was really sort of written off as, you know, virtually dead. It was used to be an all-white, all-boys school, and all the white people moved away from the area, and eventually they didn't send their kids to the school. And I was back 20 years ago, I was covering stuff in that area, and I always thought, oh, it's, you know, it's on its last leg. But it's sort of had a resurgence. And now you have, you know, like 300 kids there. And, you know, being there, they're all bright and enthusiastic. And
they were on national TV.
The choir. America's Got Talent.
The choir has sort of helped Amazing. Revive them. Yeah. But also they have a good basketball team. They're, you know, and it's nice to see this story because you don't always get these positive stories.
So Principal Shaka Rawls was on In the Loop earlier this week and talked about his hopes for the school's future.
I want us to continue to, just like he said, young black and brown boys on the south side of Chicago to live life like they can do anything that they want to do. That's why I got my PhD. That's why we won this award. It wasn't for the accolades for me. It's for the shine that the school sees. It's for the young boys to have hope. And this is what it looks like.
So congratulations to Principal Shaka Rawls and the Leo High community. Another news item from this week, you might remember the immigration raid on that South Shore apartment complex last fall. ICE agents dropping from a helicopter onto the roof in a, you know, viral video that looked like a video game. Lawyers for 18 of those residents have filed claims against the federal government. They are asking for millions in damages, and we're going to keep an eye on that story. Monica, we were expecting a judge to rule this week on whether a special prosecutor would be appointed to investigate federal agents' actions during Operation Midway Blitz, but that decision's been delayed. What's going on there?
Yeah, we all got to circuit court on Monday, including Paris and I. We were both sitting on the floor at one point. And Judge Erica Reddick said, spoiler alert, I'm not going to make an announcement today because of new evidence that was filed based on the Illinois Accountability Commission report. So the plaintiffs submitted it. The state's attorney had to respond, and now the plaintiffs are responding as we speak. And then on Thursday, on the 21st, Judge Erica Reddick will decide whether or not Eileen O'Neill Burke will be replaced by a special prosecutor when it comes to looking into alleged crimes by federal agents during Operation Midway Blitz.
And I don't know if you felt this way, but given Judge Reddick's questioning in that hearing, it felt like she was a little skeptical of Eileen O'Neill Burke, the state's attorney's arguments for not having the scope to do more, to investigate. And, you know, she's held the position that, look, we cannot start an investigation on this front. It has to be a local law enforcement agency. And then we can pick it up and we can choose whether to prosecute. I think there's some dispute about that. I mean, it doesn't seem to square with what we've seen from prosecutors.
The judge's comments made me think that maybe she's going to strike some sort of deal. Yeah. Basically, she picked apart this idea from the state's attorney's office that they can only prosecute
use of force
things, not conspiracy, not perjury. And, you know, perjury was a big deal. We heard a lot of, like,
statements. I mean, it's
statements.
A crime.
Yeah.
And even, in Lovey & Lovey, which is the public interest law firm that is bringing this, like, they want conspiracy charges, which, you know, I wonder in Minnesota, you know, in the Twin Cities, whether, because the district attorney there has been more aggressive in their public comments.
It'll be a test case to see if the feds just pluck that case from them.
Right.
You know, but they've been a lot more aggressive than the state's attorney.
But is there a conspiracy charge to bring against the entire operation, Operation Midway Blitz? And
or is
everything
there perjury?
Did?
I mean, there were a lot of, like, seemingly very false statements coming out of the feds.
And again, this echoes some of, in the progressive community, some of the dissatisfaction with the state's attorney for not being more aggressive. I mean, we've had the killing of Silverio Villegas Gonzalez, and we know that the narrative from the feds did not square with what the evidence showed, video cameras and body cams. And then you had the Let's call it an attempted killing of Mari Mar Martinez. I mean, she was shot five times. The agent in federal court, the evidence came out that he's texting and bragging about his shooting abilities. And now, I mean, there is allegedly federal probe into that agent now. So, I mean, it's not as if this is just willy-nilly stuff. This is pretty severe stuff that you would think a local prosecutor should be looking into.
Well, that is why it's in court. Last week, we witnessed the funeral of Chicago police officer John Bartholomew. He was shot at Swedish Hospital on the north side by a repeat offender with a violent history who was out on electronic monitoring. And Monica, you've been looking at the electronic monitoring program. What have you learned?
Well, when I heard that Alfonso Telli, the suspect, was out on electronic monitoring, was in violation of his release terms, had a warrant out for his arrest more than a month before he was picked up by these cops, I was like, wait a minute, how many people in Illinois are in that boat? I pestered the office of the chief judge for days and days and days. They kept promising me the info. And I found out 246 people right now who are supposed to be on electronic monitoring and have warrants out for their arrest are simply at large. They are called unaccounted for or AWOL. Mm. That was a little alarming. And State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke said that herself. The OCG, the chief judge Beach said that, you know, we want to be more transparent about this. Transparent after I bugged you guys for more than a week for this info. Yeah, real transparent. Okay, so I'm just going to calm down here. But I'm glad. They said they're going to be regularly putting out these stats. How many people are in violation of their electronic monitoring and are, in their terms, AWOL right now?
But let's just back. I mean, it's a mess. It's a mess because let's give a little context here. There were two electronic monitoring programs, one administered by the Cook County Sheriff, Tom Dart, one administered by the chief judge. Dart said, I'm done. I'm out. I'm through. I can't administer this. I don't like the fact that there are so many people that were required to put on electronic monitoring. So he gave it all to the chief judge. The chief judge has no ability to enforce it. They don't have a police arm. They don't have a law enforcement arm. So if someone's in violation, they can't. Who do they call? They call the sheriff.
Ghostbusters?
Sheriffs. Well, Ghostbusters to go find somebody.
I've heard 911 sometimes, but there just aren't a ton
of
resources.
It does not work. Clearly, it does not work the way it is right now. And it's dangerous. And we know there are repeat offenders. And something's going to have to give. And the chief judge, Beach, has basically acknowledged that, and he's got this commission to try and fix it. But how do they fix it? I mean, if it doesn't work right now, why are they even? It was alarming to me looking into this in the past. Was like there are a lot of serious felony charges that folks face, that murder, attempted murder, and they're out on electronic monitoring. I mean, maybe there's a good reason, but why? Like we deserve to know.
And if
that.
They violate the terms of the monitoring, why isn't there a faster response saying, okay, you violated your terms? On the pit, I saw that nurse, that doctor, she got picked up right away when her ankle monitor went off.
Okay, there's a pretty big difference between—
Wait, is that a TV show?
Yeah,
Real Life in Cook County and an HBO dramatic series. So why don't we leave it there? And we will keep following this story. Former mayoral candidate and the former CEO of Chicago Schools, Paul Vallis, was in the news again this week. Paris, can you elaborate?
Oops. The Board of Ethics slapped a $214,000 fine on the Vallis campaign when he ran for mayor for not complying with the city's ethics rules and ethics codes in terms of campaign contributions. And he was supposed to return a significant amount of campaign contributions that he got that were not in compliance. And apparently, according to the ethics board, that he did not do that in proper fashion or in due time. And so he slapped with his fine. Of course, Vallis claims that he's being targeted. And
where did they mail the notice?
Mary. Oh, well, thank you. That's a reference to a story that I worked on a couple of years ago, because he lives, you know, his primary residence was in Palos. He had an apartment in Bridgeport that he was laying his head at, you know, mm-hmm. to run for mayor. And so there was some controversy over his residency. But, Vallis has had campaign issues in the past. I think he ran for governor many, many years ago. His campaign was in debt. And I think that's, he has styled himself as you know, the responsible steward of the fiscal situation and of law enforcement. And, you know, there's been a lot of instances now where it feels like he can't get his own house in order on this. Now, I mean, look, Vallis is not a candidate for anything right now that we know of. So this is in the past. And of course, he's saying, you know, this is unfair. This is totally a witch hunt and whatnot. But, you know, the Board of Ethics has been really strong in recent years and just finding people in violation. And they used to never do that. So
that's true. So
they have some teeth now.
Chicago is trying to host again the next Democratic National Convention. We had members of the DNC touring Chicago again. Many of them were here in 2024. Paris, local and state leaders are trying to make their case to the Dems. What are they doing?
Well, this is what Chicago, well, they're rolling out the red carpet and serving them some Giordano's or some Lou Malnati's and some Italian beef with Jardiniere and taking them to the United Center and taking them to the top of the Willis Tower and showing them the beautiful views, but really showing them the financial ledger and saying, look, you know, this is what Chicago does. The city's hosted more political conventions than any other city by far. And the last one was in the black. And, you know, if there are problems financially, you've got the trump card of Governor J.B. Pritzker, who can, and now he doesn't want to do this, but who can maybe, you know, guarantee, you know, if things go in the red. But Chicago knows how to do this. They know how to pull off these big events, big spectacles in the black without, you know, incident. You know, there were some concerns about protesters last time, but it didn't come to fruition.
There were protests, but it didn't
lead to, like, you know, national images of like 1968 Grant Park, which was the worry. But it's a little unusual for a city to host it back to back, and also a city that's not in a swing state, because typically parties have wanted to go to swing states to try and
which
influence
that. Which is why
that.
The other contenders are in swing
they
states.
Are in,
which you've
yeah.
got Atlanta and Philly and a few and Denver. Chicago has hosted back-to-back conventions.
Right.
In fact, when they nominated FDR and when they – no, it was not 1980. It was in the 50s when they nominated Adlai Stevenson. Fun fact, my papa, Sherwood Dixon, was probably at all of those conventions.
Wow.
So
wow.
The cruise ship – that had the deadly outbreak of hantavirus. And there's a case in Illinois, Monica. Do I need to worry?
That's what I was wondering, because like the day that came out, I was going to a group singing event in a very enclosed environment where we're all going to be breathing on each other. But, you know, we're told that this case, the suspected case in Illinois, is not at all connected to the cruise ship. There is, I believe, an 8-week possible incubation period. But, you know, I looked back and to try to see, you know, okay, so are there always like 10 cases of hantavirus in Illinois every year? I saw, according to the stat I looked at, it's 7 since 1993. So it's not like, oh, we just didn't notice it in previous years. It's not that common. And given the mortality rate, the fatality rate of the one on the ship, I don't like it. I don't like that it's in Illinois at all.
Although it is a different strain. It was reported in Winnebago County, which, you know, Rockford is the county seat. Governor Pritzker was criticizing how the federal government was handling the cruise ship outbreak. What's that about?
You know, a lot of people are criticizing it. And it did feel like a guy who might be running for president wanted to take a stand against the CDC. But, you know, was there a lot more communication, you know, when COVID came out? Yeah. And should we be concerned about possible epidemics? Yeah. But it did feel a bit like grandstanding.
Yeah. It also felt a little bit like, oh, no. Is this another pandemic? Because, you know, we're still a little damaged from that.
We're getting mixed messages. So the governor's really mad. But then we talked to one of the heads of infectious disease at Northwestern. He's like, yeah, I think they're handling it pretty well. So and it's a really low risk. Well, actually, he didn't say it. He said that they could be more communicative, but very low risk.
Okay. Looking to the south suburbs. There was a case this week where a south suburban mom decided to throw the mother of all prom send-offs by having a helicopter land in the local public park. Now, the mom is the executive director of the city of Markham's Park District. Let's hear what Quintina Brown had to say.
She was graduating, and this was going to be a memorable experience. I just wanted to be able to provide that for her. I didn't think that it was going to blow up as much as it did, Sally, but I'm glad she was happy. She was able to do her photo shoot with the unexpected turn of events that had transpired and unfortunately went viral.
Prom girl Quamira Brown had this to say about the Chopper photo shoot.
It was fun, super amazing. I had such a great time.
So
I'm thankful for my mom. She brought everything together, so I'm thankful for that.
So what do we think? Mother of the year or maybe too much of a helicopter parent?
I don't know. You know, this is just a fun time to celebrate your children. I mean, I don't know why we have
with
to be so...
a helicopter?
Oh, I gotta say.
But you know what? This is, it is over the top, but some people want to be over the top. Let them be over the top. It doesn't, I don't know that it hurts anybody.
I got two words. Kobe Bryant.
Well, and maybe there was some dangerous,
ouch,
but
too soon.
People love these things. I've been to a zillion prom send-offs. I love them. They're, you know, it's just nice to see the kids all dressed up and they look like little mini adults. And I don't know. It's fun. It's just fun.
Well, lucky for you, Sarah, you did not do this and you're not the executive director of the Markham Park District because now Markham has filed suit against Quintina Brown because they felt maybe she had overstepped her bounds a little bit.
A little bit, maybe.
Turning to local media news, of which you are all very clued in, and Sarah and Paris, you especially are clued into one of the big stories. You've been the center of an investigation by a law firm hired by
the
Chicago School Board over leaked information during the search for a new CEO. So what's going on?
Yeah, this was sort of unusual. I really think of this as part of this transition from Chicago Public Schools having an appointed board where, you know, things were very tightly kept. Now they have a hybrid board or partly elected. And then eventually we're going to have a fully elected board. And they're having a little problem sort of understanding the role of the media and a public government and some of this back and forth. But essentially, they were in the middle of this investigation, search for a new CEO. And like any and every probably reporter that covers CPS, we were all calling around trying to figure out who was the next, who are the finalists. And I found out and I put out a story and they launched an investigation into how I found out. So,
and to be clear, CPS did not dispute your reporting. They just wanted to know where you got it.
They were especially mad because one of the finalists actually dropped out within hours of us publishing the story. And they said that it's because of you that he dropped out. And the whole search sort of was put on hold for a while. I will say, though, the guy that dropped out and that whose name was out there, within hours of putting out that story, we got a lot of information about him from people in, it was a Denver superintendent, from people in Denver, from people in Chicago. And I actually think that if it would have moved forward, that information would have been very important to know. So I think the bigger question is, why were they not making the names of the finalists public? I think that lots of school districts do that so that there can be a public vetting, and I think they should have done that.
So CPS has spent about $60,000 on this investigation into the leak, which didn't turn up much. And of course, we know CPS is facing some shortage of money. So Paris, do we think that this was worth it for them to investigate something that was done legally?
No, I mean, it was never going to turn out anything. And it was a waste of money. Obviously, they hired a law firm, Salvatore Prescott Porter and Porter, I think is the name. And, you know, we're not sure exactly how much money they spent on it. Yes, there's a ledger that says they've paid $60,000 to this law firm. Is it just for this investigation? We're not entirely sure. Hardin said it was more like $25,000. So we don't really know. But it's significant money. I mean, it's not insignificant when you've got every penny that you've got to count. And there was no law that was violated here. There was no rule that was violated here. When the investigation expanded to me, it was because I had gotten word that they were going to schedule a special public meeting, board meeting, where they went and raised the property tax levy. And the public has to know that. And I just tweeted that out. And I told Board President Hardin, who launched this investigation, that my source was not on the school board. So he was trying to find leakers on his board. And his rationale was that we need to have a process that's smooth and we can't have leakers. And it kind of has a chilling effect. But at the end of the day, this law firm, which contacted both Sarah and I, trying to get us to give up our sources. Obviously, we did not participate. At the end of the day, they put out a report for these tens of thousands of dollars saying we couldn't find the leaker. And, you know, that's kind of the end of the story here. And Hardin says, well, it was worth it because it established that we can't have leakers. I mean, the whole thing is kind of a bizarre exercise. It was a big faux pas for President Hardin. And,
whenever this kind of thing happens, it's usually meant to discourage future leaks.
I think so. I think
and
so.
Journalism.
Yeah. Right,
which, of
right.
course,
and
we
to
don't.
Discourage journalists.
Of course, we're not for that. We're for leaks.
Final investigative, and then I'll get Monica. It was leaked to me, the final investigative report. So it's not discouraging anything.
And as someone whose only journalism class was taken at CPS, at Lane Tech, I was told to protect my sources. That's what CPS taught me to do. And so the fact that I, as a taxpayer, saw $25,000 to $60,000 spent on this from a district that is cash-strapped is kind of mind-blowing to me.
Well, thank you all for protecting your sources, for practicing journalism, and for staying out of the pokey, at least for this week. We'll see what happens next week. That's it for the Weekly News Recap. My thanks to Monica Eng of Axios, WBEZ Sarah Karp, and Paris Schutz.
I'll be on electronic monitoring, so it'll be fine.
Of NBC5.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.